Today on New Horizons, Steve Netto of the Idaho Department of Fish and Game talking about wolf management issues in Idaho.
The wolf population is the highest monitored. We actually know more about our wolf population than any other species in the state. At the end of last year, we had about 70% of our known packs radio collar. Fish and Wildlife Service has quite a system set up. They know how to list species, and they know how to work on species recovery and write recovery plans. However, they have not delisted very many species. Wolves have pretty much saturated the optimal habitat in our three states. And from here, they're expanding their populations in areas where they're just getting into real high conflict.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Steve Netto is a biologist with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Since 2002, he has served as the agency's statewide large carnivore coordinator, overseeing programs for wolves, mountain lions, black bears, and grizzly bears. Gray wolves were reintroduced to central Idaho and Yellowstone National Park 13 years ago. At the end of 2007, those wolves numbered more than 1,500 across Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana, including 700 here in Idaho. With this year's new litters, there are now about 1,000 wolves in Idaho. In March, gray wolves in the Northern Rockies were removed from the Federal Endangered Species List, and the responsibility for the wolves' management passed to the states. In May, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game recommended a wolf hunting season in order to manage the population. As questions continue over the future of wolves in Idaho, we invited Steve Netto on our program today to help us understand some of the issues involved in wolf management. Steve has a bachelor's degree in wildlife management from the University of Maine and a master's in wildlife biology from the University of Montana. He has worked for federal and state agencies since 1979. Steve Netto, welcome to New Horizons.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning, I guess. When wolves were reintroduced into Idaho, what was the considered opinion of the wildlife biologist as to the optimum number of wolves that could make it in Idaho and not disturb their disturb humans, I guess, because that's really what's going on right now?
Well, the environmental impact statement that was written by the Fish and Wildlife Service, along with cooperators in the three different states, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, also participated in development of that EIS to look at some of the impacts and some of the potential population levels. And what they figured at the time was a recovered population. They also looked out at and inquired among the renowned wolf scientists across the globe and asked what a recovered population would look like. And in the Northern Rocky Mountains, they estimated that there would be 300 wolves well distributed among the three states of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, including Yellowstone, and about 30 breeding pair. And a breeding pair was defined as, you know, two adult wolves that produced two pups that survived to the end of the year. So that showed reproduction. So 30 breeding pair, 300 wolves, about 100 wolves in each state. And currently we're, with this year's pup production, we're at about 10 times the level that was estimated adequate for recovery, and also 10 times the level that we looked at for potential impacts to humans and other resources.
So how does that happen? How could they be so far off?
Well, the Endangered Species Act is, it's not a push-button sort of legislation. Congress enacted it to recover species, and it's a very powerful piece of legislation, as you know. They began in 2002, actually. We reached those recovery levels of 300 wolves, 3 years, consecutive years running, which was, and the EIS actually predicted that to be about the time, amazingly enough, that wolves would be recovered. Very short span, highly productive animals, very robust populations. But it took since 2002 till current time for the Fish and Wildlife Service to go through all of the requirements. Part of that is the state's requirements, and the states were required to provide adequate regulatory mechanisms. In other words, we had to have plans and laws in place that would assure long-term survival and viable populations of wolves over the long, the eons to come. And so Wyoming was kind of the outlier. Idaho jumped right in. We actually had the first plan that was written and accepted by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then the Montana's came second, and then Wyoming did battle for a while. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that if, in fact, the Endangered Species Act had just been lifted from the wolves around 2002 or 3, you obviously wouldn't be dealing with the numbers you're dealing with now, because you'd have hunting seasons and you'd have a culling of the population.
Right. We'd be looking at a much lower population, correct? Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the hunting season. Do we know yet when that's going to be? Do we know the rules of engagement?
Well, first off, the whole delisting thing is still in the courts.
Right.
12 plaintiffs, environmental groups, actually filed for an injunction to prevent the states from taking over wolf management as a delisted species. That hearing was held May 29th in Missoula, Montana, and Judge Malloy said that he would get back to us soon. And you know, we're looking at 3 weeks plus right now, and we haven't heard back yet. So that's still up in the air. We're feeling pretty positive about that at this stage of the game. Maybe we're reading into it too far. But if the judge goes ahead and agrees that wolves should remain delisted, then we will go forward with hunting season in the three states. And in Idaho, it would begin in the backcountry, in the Selway and Frank Church, September 15th. It would run to the end of December during the prime big game hunting seasons, prime pelt quality period. And we'd be looking at managing populations and maintaining wolf populations at between 500 and 700 wolves, which was about the 2005 to 2007 mm-hmm. population levels. The Fish and Game Commission voted for maintaining the population at the lower end of that to see if we could get there right out of the chute.
So you'd be taking out 300 or 400 wolves then?
Right. And the way that it's set up is a total mortality limit, which means every time a wolf is killed on the road, every time a wolf is killed for control actions around livestock, every time a wolf is killed by another wolf that we're able to find and record, those all add into the mortality limit. Mm-hmm. And we also add in harvest, regulated harvest. And once that mortality limit is reached, then the season for wolf hunting would be closed in that zone, or if the statewide quota was reached or limit was reached, then it would be closed statewide.
Now, how many hunters will have access to this hunting?
Well, the way we're setting it up right now is anybody that wants to buy a wolf tag could. But once they harvested a wolf, they would have to call in within 3 days to report that they harvested a wolf. They'd have to actually bring the hide and skull in to a Fish and Game office to have it checked within 10 days. So with a three-day reporting period, we figured that that would give us enough of a dial-in so that once we got the quota or neared the quota, then we could shut the season down in advance. So we're looking at, you know, if it's anything similar to bears or lions, we'd be looking at 20 to 30,000 wolf hunters out there.
On a first-come, first-served basis, in a way.
Well, anybody that wants one can buy one. Yeah. I mean, whether or not they actually plan on hunting wolves, you know, or they could have a wolf tag in their pocket. But we think that with the reporting requirements that we have, we'll be okay. Mm-hmm. We have a real flexible ability to close seasons if we see things coming down. Mm-hmm. And we think that wolves are going to be kind of hard to hunt, particularly the second year. The first year, they're going to learn that the guys out there in the woods now are shooting.
Right.
And they're a little bit... I mean, wolves are really smart animals. Mm-hmm. You know, they pick things up fast. They're already pretty secretive. I mean, they're already hard to see. Mm-hmm. And once they become hunted, they'll probably become a little more hard to see.
Are the boundaries easy to distinguish? I'm thinking of the hunter who's out there in the Selway and wanders over the boundary line that you've established. That's pretty painful consequences, I would assume.
Well, you know, the same consequences hold for all of our big game animals. Yeah. And the hunter's pretty used to these boundaries. Okay. You know, they're usually ridge tops or major highways or drainages, something fairly significant. Now, you know, I've been stuck on a hill looking at a moose through my sights wondering, well, is he on my side of the hill or on the other side?
Right.
And you know, everybody goes through those torturous decisions during the hunting season.
Right. Let's go back to the judge's decision, the lawsuit that's been filed last spring. And I'm a little confused over the nature of the lawsuit. Is not the Endangered Species Act clear on the delisting issue, that once it's delisted, it automatically reverts to the state, or it does not automatically revert to the state? Because that seems to be the basis for this lawsuit. And I guess I don't understand what the contention is of the plaintiffs here.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, mm-hmm. but the plaintiffs believe that, you know, there aren't adequate regulatory mechanisms in place, that they didn't like the Wyoming plan because Wyoming plan says that the majority of the state is actually in a predator zone. Mm-hmm. Of course, the majority of the state is in, there are no wolves or very few wolves, mm-hmm. and the majority of the wolves in the northwestern part of the state, and there they're listed as a trophy game species, mm-hmm. and so there they have regulated hunting. But the plaintiffs think that, you know, that's too lax. You know, they don't like the idea of being able to shoot a wolf, poison wolves, etc., any time of the year. So they attacked Wyoming, and they also attacked Idaho in some of our rules and regulations, but we think that that we're pretty solid there, mm-hmm. and we have the most wolves and the very robust populations. But they think that they can ask the judge or tell the judge that the two points that they made, one is there's not real good connectivity with the Yellowstone population. They don't, you know, based on some old DNA data that was actually published in, I think, 2002, they don't think that the there's enough breeding going on, connectivity from outside populations that actually are breeding with Yellowstone wolves to have that, that whole genetic diversity thing. That was in 2002. Since, I mean, we've got a lot of documented wolves, radio collars going in and out and around Yellowstone. We don't see that as a problem genetically over the long term, that they're connected now, and we're managing for that in our plants. And secondly, they don't think that there's enough wolves. They're just looking at a numbers game, not a habitat, optimal habitat, low conflict sorts of things. And we, the managers, including the Fish and Wildlife Service in the three state areas, realize that wolves have pretty much saturated the optimal habitat in our three states. And from here, they're expanding their populations in areas where they're just getting into real high conflict, private land, low elevation stuff. We're seeing more and more wolves around people's backyards, and they just shouldn't be everywhere in the state unless we expect to have that level of high conflict and, mm-hmm. and high management activity. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is two things. One is connectivity and the populations aren't high enough. And then the third one is inadequate regulatory mechanism.
Yeah.
And I ask the question not because I am necessarily taking a side here. I'm definitely not, because I wouldn't know enough to take a side on this issue. But I was just curious about the basis for it. And obviously, it's just the fact that they don't think the state is prepared to do this. I assume that's really what
they're
saying.
I think that's one of their things. Yeah. But they've had fear about state management from the outset. When we took on wolf management as a designated agent for the Fish and Wildlife Service 2-3 years ago now, mm-hmm. They predicted gloom and doom at that time, and the wolf population continued to increase at 20-24% a year. Mm-hmm. So they've been making these dire predictions mm-hmm. over the last several years, and they've all been false. And we think that it's just kind of a fear-related thing, not necessarily a factual-related mm-hmm. thing.
Now, you're talking about a hunt that's going to take place in the Selway, and yet a lot of the complaints I hear from legislators and ranchers around Boise are from areas that aren't too far away from here in central Idaho. And I just wonder, this hunt, does this necessarily appease those who are in parts of the state, the ranchers and the sheep herders?
Well, maybe I wasn't clear enough on we're actually going to hunt wolves statewide. And our wolf hunting plan actually calls for higher harvest in areas where we have high conflicts.
Oh, okay.
And so we're going to have higher harvest in the front country where we're seeing all these problems, and we're actually trying to get into that, mm-hmm. you know, reducing populations in these suboptimal habitats, these mm-hmm. front country ranges where we really don't think wolves can live long and prosper without causing a lot of mm-hmm. conflict. And so we're trying to combine basically three legs to this wolf management plan. And anytime you're dealing with wolves, you have to look at proactive sorts of things in the front country where, you know, you work with ranchers, and we're moving this more and more as a delisted species into the regions. And the regions know the local ranchers and livestock producers, and they're working with them closely to find ways to improve husbandry, maybe to reduce some of these conflicts, giving them a hand with doing that through providing materials and maybe receivers so they can find these wolves and avoid den sites, those sorts of things. And secondly, you know, there's going to always have to be lethal control associated with wolves and wolf conflicts, because once they learn about, you know, mutton and beef, you can't correct them afterwards. So you got to kind of remove these problem wolves. And then you're looking at compensation. You know, ranchers and livestock producers shouldn't be the ones taking it on their back. And so we have to realistically compensate them for their losses mm-hmm. over the long time. And part of this population management will come with hunting.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, wolf reintroduction has been enormously successful. And from the reports I've read, there are even some claims that I frankly don't understand. For example, I think there was one magazine, Biological Conservation, which reported the first significant growth of aspen in over a half a century in Yellowstone, and it was in the context of wolf reintroduction. Help me understand how wolves help the aspen population.
The trophic cascade issue is actually more contentious now in the scientific world than one might think, but the you know, the Yellowstone system is a great area to look at these sorts of impacts. And a top predator like a wolf is going to have some impacts, you know, whether they're behavioral, population level, but they're going to have some impacts. And what they're seeing in Yellowstone, what they've been able to determine is that elk populations are spending less time in the lower elevations around the creek bottom, the river bottoms, and these flat open meadows like you're familiar with in Yellowstone, and more time in the steeper slope timbered areas to avoid predation by wolves. And by so doing, they're not spending so much time feeding on the willow complexes and pounding the vegetation. But also, the population in Yellowstone, elk population, has reduced fairly dramatically. So you're looking at fewer elk doing the impacts as well as their mm-hmm. behavioral changes. Bison numbers are increasing because less vegetation competition. So we have real high bison numbers in Yellowstone. A lot of the what we call meso carnivores or middle-sized carnivores like coyotes and foxes and the ravens and the crows, and you know, they're all benefiting, and so are grizzly bears. Mm-hmm. But the complexity of that is, how do you measure that? Because we also, in 1988, less than a decade before reintroduction, we had the major fires going through there, and fires help invigorate aspen growth, and you know, all these things occur at the same time. And so for scientists to tease those issues apart and to do those, you know, the measurements on, you know, it's very, very complex. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of discussion in the scientific community as to the validity of that mm-hmm. currently.
You're listening to Steve Netto. He's with U.S. Department of Fish and Game, and as you can tell, we're talking about wolf reintroduction and now, of course, the delisting of the wolves. Let's talk about how you, as wildlife biologists in Fish and Game, keep track of these critters. You obviously have radio collars. Of the Idaho population, what percentage have radio collars?
Well, it's actually a very big part of our work here in Idaho with the Fish and Game Department. Right now, well, at the end of last year, we had about 70% of our known packs radio collared, 60 to 70% of our known packs radio collared. It's what we do through the summer. Right now, I have a full staff out there trying to put radios on wolves and count pups, visit den sites, and verify reproduction. Mm-hmm. And then we try to put one to two radios in each pack. So for wildlife species, the wolf population is the highest monitor. We actually know more about our wolf population than any other species in the state, just simply due to that fact mm-hmm. of the high number of radio collars.
So how do you get these radio collars? And I know I could say very carefully, but other than that, how do you get these radio collars on these wolves?
Well, they're a wolf has a home range or territory of 250 to 300 square miles, and catching up to them is pretty tough. So we spend a lot of time scouting.
Helicopter?
And, ground, mostly. Ground, actually. Mostly. Yeah, we do count wolves from the air, and we locate them that way. But most of our summer work is done on the ground. Mm-hmm. Once you locate a new pack, for instance, it's usually from public reportings. It's helpful, you know, a flurry of public reportings in an area, and or where we go visit the site, and you see, you walk down a trail or drive down a road, and you see lots of wolf sign going back and forth, and you're localized, and then you can put a trap out there. And you're trying to get a wolf with a 250 square mile territory to step on a on a trap with a pan size that's about 3 inches wide.
What kind of a trap is it?
It's a leg hold or a foothold trap, steel foothold trap. We have padded jaws to reduce the injury on wolves, and we've had very good success with those padded jaws as far as reducing injury. And we use a scent lure, typically, and maybe a little bit of cat food or something in there. Mm-hmm. And wolves are very oriented into their nose. I mean, they're four legs and a nose and some sharp teeth.
Right.
And they travel great distances, 20 to 40 miles a day. So if there's a rendezvous site where they have their pups and they keep coming back to there, you know, kind of the hub of their wheel, then you can concentrate your trapping effort around these concentrated areas and increase your chances of catching one. So, you know, it's hard work, and we have guys that put an awful lot of time out there trying to catch wolves. But, well, the Nez Perce tribe is also working with us on our wolf management, wolf monitoring, and they are also trapping. They have two or three biologists that are out all summer long as well. Mm-hmm. So we put out 30 radio collars a summer, and then in the winter we've been also darting wolves from the air. And, you know, we'll have one radio collar in a pack. We find them, and then we can actually, with the helicopter, go in and dart them and put a collar on the snow, which is very successful, too.
Now, I assume you're darting them as well when you get them in the leg trap. I don't think they're going to be too kindly, much appreciate the fact that you come up with them after you get them in the leg trap.
It's interesting thing about wolves, you know, people think of them as very, very aggressive animals because they eat meat for a living, you know, and really they're pretty submissive when you get them in traps. They're trying to get away,
yeah.
You know, they're caught, you know, and they live on their feet and their ability to get around, and now all of a sudden they can't. So there's that, you know, sometimes you walk up to a trap and these wolves are just curled up and just totally fearful. And I mean, even the alpha wolves sometimes are that way. We had a wolf a couple years ago that my guys tell me about where they walked up and they had this alpha male in a trap, and they're usually the most aggressive of any of the pack animals. And he was pulling the drag. There's a length of chain and a drag, and he was caught up with the drag, but he pulled it loose when they came up. So one of the biologists went over and stood on the chain, you know, with the wolf on the other end of the chain, perfectly able to, you know, bite him or attack him. And he told the other biologist, stand on here while I go get the drugs. And so the other biologist stood on the drag at the end of this, you know, 4 foot length of chain with the alpha male wolf on the other side, snarling and howling and snapping his jaws. And he was perfectly able at that time. And it, you know, if there was any reason to attack, he could have at that time.
Sure.
And out of fear and everything else. I mean, a dog had been on that situation, he would have bit him.
Yeah.
But a wolf was just totally freaked.
Yeah.
And so he came back with the drugs and put a catch pole usually around their neck, hold them down, and then either hand syringe them or use a jab stick.
How does the rest of the pack react when a wolf is collared like that? Not collared, but trapped.
Well, it depends whether or not other wolves are around. Sometimes, for instance, if you catch a pup or a subadult or, say, the alpha male may be hanging around and barking and chirping and have his hackles up and running around you, trying to scare you off to protect his pack mate. But we've never had any wolves lunge or do anything like that during the hundreds of wolves that we've handled.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the delisting decision. Where did the decision to delist originate? Does that originate among wildlife biologists like yourselves who are working and can see the changes occurring? Or does it come from top down? Obviously, there's a lot of political pressure on this issue.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, the environmental impact statement was written, the wolf recovery plan. You know, the Fish and Wildlife Service has quite a system set up. However, they have not delisted very many species. And so it's kind of new to them. They know how to list species, and they know how to work on species recovery and write recovery plans, but this whole delisting thing is not a push-button system. And also the whole courts, you know, the tail end is, they're constantly being challenged. Almost every species is being proposed for delisting is being challenged. So the Endangered Species Act has several different aspects to it, and wolves are reintroduced into Idaho and in central or into Yellowstone under Section 10J of the Endangered Species Act. And that's called an experimental non-essential population. So you're actually able to write your rules. And one of the aspects of that is, what will the recovered population level be? And that was written in the recovery plan as well as environmental impact statement, be 100 wolves. and look at the impacts of that. Now, that's a minimum. That's a floor level. And everybody had always expected that you couldn't manage at exactly 100 wolves. We're not that good. We're not that smart. We're not that capable. And the wolves are too secretive to be able to know exactly if you're at 99 or 110 or whatever. So you need to have a little buffer to prove to the Fish and Wildlife Service and the nation that you're managing for long term. So anyways, the Fish and Wildlife Service then set up the recovery goals. They do that for all species, that they're reproductively capable of maintaining viable populations. And at that level, then, once they reach those goals, then they begin the process of delisting, which is a lengthy process in this case.
Mm-hmm. Do wolves in any way play a role in the tourism factor in Idaho?
Well, they certainly do in Yellowstone, one of the places where we have good information on that. You know, it's pretty big business because the wolves are very visible in Yellowstone, the wide open spaces, and people can routinely drive to spots, you know, at first light and sit there with their spotting scopes and see wolves. Idaho doesn't have the same kind of habitat or conditions typically throughout the state. And so routinely being able to go somewhere and see wolves on a regular basis is very, very tough.
Yeah, you can't do that in Idaho, I assume.
You can't do that in most places. Now, we do have some areas in the state where a lot of people do go and occasionally see wolves, and particularly in the wintertime when elk are down on winter range, there's a little more opportunity for seeing wolves close to the elk in winter range. For instance, between Boise and Loman in the Grand Junction country up in there, real big winter range area, and a lot of elk and deer winter there, normal winter. Well, this year in particular, we're down real low next to the highway, and a lot of wolves are seen up there. And we also have a lot of wolf activity in the Stanley Basin and over in the Sun Valley country and Bear Valley. I mean, there's a lot of places that's kind of wide open, a little more open, and occasionally people go out there and see wolves, and we do have reports of wolves in the open and around the elk and so forth. So, you know, as far as being a tourism draw, I don't think that we've capitalized on that much yet. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of people in the state that would like to see that, but we really haven't gotten there yet, and I'm not sure that we ever really will be able to, just simply because of this is Idaho. We have, you know, management activities going on. It's not this little panacea like Yellowstone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I was going to say we don't have a large national park right in the middle of the
exactly,
state.
Yeah.
Of course, I mentioned earlier that the ranchers have certainly had their problems, and the sheep farmers as well. Are there examples of wolves and farmers and ranchers coexisting in such a fashion that you have people who in those areas understand the role of the wolf in the wild and can control it on their own?
Livestock producers have come a long way in the state, really. Most of the problems that we're getting are in some of these chronic conflict areas, but where the ranchers are having to deal with new wolf packs moving in where they haven't had to deal with them before, there's a learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to work more closely with those. You know,
it's an education process. It's definitely an educational
process. Now, you know, we've been working a long time with the livestock community, and they've come a long way in understanding wolf behavior and biology and learning to work with them and accept some level of conflict. But, you know, they don't seem to like wolves any more than they did. They're just accepting them more, similar to the other large carnivores now because they've lived with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're willing to work, you know, with the understanding that wolves are here to stay, and I'm real positive about the livestock community in the state. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time, Steve, but I do appreciate your joining us today, and best of luck with the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
Steve Netto, thank you for joining us today on New Horizons. Next week, Heather Ray, an independent filmmaker and producer of Frozen River, winner of the Grand Jury Prize for Drama at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Julie Hahn. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons. We'll be right back.